Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello and welcome to another episode of You Solved a Mystery, a podcast where we discuss segments of the iconic unsolved mysteries that have been solved and reveal the final chapter. I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra. And if we sound exactly the same, it's because we're twins.
So today's story came from special number 6.
And I don't have any idea what it is. You, listener of the future, currently know more about what is to come than I do, if you read the episode description that I'm sure Athena will write.
So episode number 6, I should say special number 6, is not available online. And this segment was not reworked into the series with Robert Stack. So it cannot be viewed online by anyone who didn't record the series off of television on a VHS. And I'm sure there are people out there somewhere who have those VHS tapes deep inside their garage.
I'm sure it has to exist somewhere.
Somewhere. But anyway, special number 6 was hosted by Robert Stack. And one of these days, I'm going to do a background on Robert Stack like I did for Raymond Burr and Mladen Cechlovic. But Stack's relationship with Unsolved Mysteries was so much more dynamic and deserves more time. So I'll get there at some point. I'm trying to go for a certain length of episode.
Sounds good.
Special number 6 originally premiered May 6th, 1988. This is a wanted segment, and I'm excited. Do you know why?
I don't know why.
It's another bank robbery.
Oh.
The victimless crime! So although this was cut from Unsolved Mysteries, there's an episode of, I think it's a Canadian TV show called Masterminds, called The Disappearing Man, that I was able to find to get a little television media input about this episode, in addition to all of my newspapers.com research. In 1983, Stephen Riley Hadley was a 36-year-old father of three and manager at the John Deere Employees Credit Union in Waterloo, Iowa. He was well-liked by his coworkers, described as a great person to work for. Stephen and his wife, Catherine, seemed to others to get along well, and had three children, ages 1, 7, and 11. Stephen was, in all regards, normal. A well-respected man about town, doing the best thing so conservatively. So we can only imagine the shock his wife felt when he called her one morning in April and told her to look for a letter he had left in a drawer, and that she would never see him again. And this shock must have been compounded among all who knew him when, that same day, it was discovered that over $1 million was missing from the vault of the credit union where he worked. It started as a joke among coworkers about how easy it would be. But the thought experiment didn't end for Stephen Hadley. It grew into an idea, then a plan, then reality. On July 21st, 1983, Hadley arrived at work. It was longtime bank manager Leighton Stump's last day before retirement, so employees were more distracted and jovial than usual. During his lunch break, Hadley reserved a flight under the name Robert Johnson, picked up a rental car, and purchased a wig and two carefully selected wheeled suitcases. When the regularly scheduled payroll was delivered that afternoon, Hadley packed it into three cardboard boxes in full view of the vault's video camera. He waved at the camera as he left.
Oh, so he was just brazen about this.
Mm-hmm.
He was just like, peace out.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Earlier in the day, he had tampered with the credit union's cash accounting system so the teller's computers wouldn't balance correctly and they'd be preoccupied and less likely to notice anything odd. He carried the boxes through the office, pretending he was transferring office supplies to another branch. He made three individual trips to his car. A fellow coworker saw him carrying one heavy box and held the door open for him as he left. loaded his rental car, and drove away. Before walking away from the job and his formal life forever, he signed manager Leighton Stump's retirement card, quote, "Just remember, Leighton, don't go out with a whimper, but with a bang," end quote. Stephen Hadley had carefully crafted this heist. He had started planning several months earlier. Hadley had been responsible for ordering the payroll that arrived that day. Usually, the bank received around $900,000. He ordered $1,136,000.
That's the difference.
It was the most money the bank had ever held.
And nobody raised their eyebrows? Nobody raised any questions?
The money arrived that morning, and as head teller, he signed for it and began unbagging the cash. But instead of loading it into the vault, he loaded it directly into his cardboard boxes. Hadley wasn't the usual head teller, but he'd secured himself the shift by proposing he cross-train with the head teller so he could, conveniently, fill in when she went out of town.
The stars really lined up for him to have the head teller going out of town and this final day, goodbye, party-ish day for the manager.
This was carefully crafted, but he probably smiled as he fell asleep the night he found out Leighton Stubbs was retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Before the robbery, Hadley had been seen in the vault with a cardboard box, which was generally against policy, but being such a small credit union where everyone trusted him, it was overlooked. Employees later put it together that he was measuring, calculating how much money fit into one box so he would know how many boxes he needed. He had joked that he would never consider robbing the bank unless he knew he could get away with $1 million. He had to measure the boxes to make sure he got his haul.
That's a really weird thing to joke about when you work at a bank.
I would probably joke about it, though, if I worked at a bank.
I feel like it's like working on an airplane and joking about a bomb.
I don't know. A bomb in an airplane seems so much more destructive than a bank robbery. Especially if you're a teller who's joking about robbing your own bank. Can't you imagine that kind of gallows humor of you all work together doing the job day after day? Like, I used to joke that I spent half my time in jail. In planning for the heist, Hadley had convinced his work to send him to a seminar that went over techniques used by people trying to commit fraud, intending to teach people how to recognize when they're being defrauded. Spoiler, that's not how he used the programming. He had told his wife he was going out of town on July 21st, so she wouldn't become suspicious when he didn't come home the night of the robbery. And the evening before, he tucked his daughter into bed and told her, "Sometimes adults do stupid things, but it doesn't mean they don't love you."
Excuse me? He decided to trade his family in for $1 million. That's cold.
Yeah, that's what makes him a bit of an asshole.
A bit.
A bit. The morning after the robbery, Hadley called Catherine and told her to read a note he had left behind in his sock drawer. It read in part, quote, "This is a very difficult letter to write, but I couldn't let you find out from someone else. If I call you to read this letter, it means that I had successfully left the state with around $1 million from the credit union. I started to fantasize about how easy it would be to get so much money. It has become a game to come up with ideas about how to do it and cover my trail. I don't expect you to understand what is compelling me to do something this drastic," end quote.
I should hope not. I don't know how anybody could possibly understand their longtime spouse ditching them over money.
The $1 million I get, the ditching the children and spouse. Not so much.
I wouldn't trade you for $1 million.
I wouldn't trade you for $1 million either.
That was a lot nicer than the time that you said you probably wouldn't kill me, so I appreciate it.
I heart you. According to the show Masterminds, the letter also included the sentiment that Hadley felt looked over by work, the children didn't respect him anymore, and he was sorry for the trouble his actions would cause.
Oh, barf. The children didn't respect him.
They're 1, 5, and 11.
Barf.
In Supernatural, Bobby has this quote that's like, kids aren't supposed to say thank you. They're supposed to eat your food and break your heart. It's thought that the motive for the robbery was that he was tired of his life and angry about, after over 10 years of dedicated work, getting overlooked for a promotion to the main branch that went to a younger man. Hadley ended the phone call by saying that Catherine would never see him again. That same morning, the money was discovered stolen. Hadley's rental car was found abandoned in the Waterloo Airport parking lot, with the wig and currency wrappings from the stolen money still inside.
Why did he have a wig when he was so unabashed about waving to the camera?
That's actually a pretty good question. I guess it was a matter of just being able to drive to the airport without being recognized if anyone did notice the money was missing. Just really trying to cover his tracks. Hadley flew to Chicago, then LA, then Dallas, where he used the name Mark Stone. In Dallas, he slipped up. He bought a used car, and when asked his name, quickly responded, Hadley, without thinking.
Ooh, this is why you don't change, well, your first name.
The last name, that's probably the one that should be changed. Lucky for him, the salesman wrote it Hatley with a T instead of a D. But it might have been the reason he moved on to Houston, where he adopted the name and identity of Richard Finley. Remember that seminar I mentioned that he attended about recognizing fraud techniques?
Honestly, no. We've been in this closet for 25 minutes.
It's getting hot in here. So he had convinced his work to send him to a seminar to recognize fraud techniques. At that seminar, they actually explained how people could obtain documents in the name of an infant who passed away shortly after birth in order to use their identity for fraud.
So this was a how to identify fraud or how to commit fraud?
It was definitely how to identify fraud, but no good deed goes unpunished. If you teach someone how to identify fraud, they might just learn how to commit fraud, it turns out. So Hadley learned how to obtain the documents of an infant who had passed away, and that's exactly what he did. The real Richard Finley was born February 12th, 1948, and sadly died at 2 days old.
Poor baby.
Hadley legally acquired Finley's birth certificate. At the time, Texas required only one form of ID to get a driver's license, so after using baby Richard's birth certificate to get a license, he took both the license and birth certificate to the Social Security office to get a Social Security card.
Are you kidding me? I spent 11 hours at the DMV trying to get a driver's license here.
Stephen Hadley is the reason you have to give a blood pact just to rent a car these days. It's people like him.
I had to go get a copy of my Social Security card before I was allowed to get a Texas driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how easy it was to get a Washington driver's license? Do you know how much I appreciate that?
For a while, Hadley continued to phone Catherine from different locations. She said on the phone that he sounded depressed and asked him, if he's so unhappy, why doesn't he just turn himself in? To which he replied, quote, well, I'm not that depressed.
Wow. Dude.
He sent gifts to the kids every few months at first. And while the police would typically seize items known to be purchased with stolen money, they realized these kids were going through a hard time and couldn't bring themselves to take the toys away.
Oh, a little bit of compassion mm-hmm. in the world. It's almost unheard of.
But eventually, the contact and the gifts stopped.
Let me guess. He moved to an island in the Caribbean and got a 20-year-old girlfriend?
No, actually. He's not that predictable. This whole thing. from being the well-respected man about town to what he does with his money. No one could have seen any of it coming.
Does he start an orphanage?
No. But he was making the most of his new life. In Houston, he bleached his hair, got a tan, and wore t-shirts and shorts instead of his stuffy suits, and wore blue contacts to disguise his eye color.
Ooh, he's really living at large now.
He took advantage of his ill-gotten fortune and found new hobbies. He signed up for flying lessons at Houston's Hobby Airport.
Dork.
Where he took a shining to his flying instructor, Roxy Ann Alden.
Nerd.
And they began dating.
I'm not good at insults.
I think flying lessons are kind of cool. And I think it's cool that his flying instructor was a woman in 1984. So
I just don't think it's cool that he ditched his entire family and is now taking up the hobby of flying.
And as much as I want to, in fact, as much as I do enjoy this story, that never left my mind. Real asshole move, man. But he began dating his flying instructor, Roxy. And of course her name is Roxy.
She sounds really cool, okay?
But it's one of those things where if this was fiction, I would be like, no, that's too on the nose. Her name can't be Roxy. Do something realistic. But yeah, it's badass that she was a flight instructor. Having worked in banking, Hadley knew to put his money in numerous accounts to stay under the $10,000 cash reporting requirement. For the bulk of it, he went to a man he met through Roxy named C.A. Jacquemins, who made international investments. Hadley told him he wanted to save on taxes, and Jacquemins set up a Panama Corporation account for him that held about $910,000. 8 months after meeting, on April 20th, 1984, Hadley and Roxy married and settled down in a town called Friendswood. That year, 1984, Family Circle magazine had named Friendswood, which was founded as a Quaker community, one of 12 great safe places to live. Hadley and Roxy bought a house. And a Ferrari. And an Alfa Romeo, which is another flashy sports car. They took trips to Mexico and the ski slopes of Colorado. And they caught the attention of Friendswood Police Lieutenant Gary Edwards. The Des Moines Register described Friendswood as a place where people minded their own business, but also, quote, a place where police zero in on what they consider to be suspicious, end quote. One of Hadley's neighbors was quoted saying, quote, if someone throws a pop bottle in your front yard, you can call the police and they'll be right out to investigate it, end quote. So if you asked me it was an overpoliced hellscape, maybe try talking to your neighbor about throwing their trash in your yard. Lieutenant Edwards was so inquisitive, which is my nice word for nosy, about this couple with the cars that outpriced their home that he began investigating them. According to Officer Mike Tollett, the cars, quote, didn't fit the neighborhood, end quote. So they ran a, quote, routine check, end quote. I assume they thought they were stolen.
I'm just getting some real mixed messages about this town because it's supposed to be so safe, but also you suspect everybody of crimes.
It sounds like a hellscape. Honestly. As they investigated, the police found there had never been any liens on the cars, which meant they'd been paid for in cash. In all his nosy glory, Edwards checked the house and found that, too, was bought flat out with a certified check. He found that Finley didn't have a job or clear means of support. So how did he afford $90,000 worth of cars and a $70,000 house?
I would just assume family money.
Probably same. I wouldn't be so nosy about it. I let people live their lives with their fancy cars and their $70,000 house.
But also be super judgmental when you found out that somebody ditched their entire family.
Yeah, it's not cool, Hadley. So Edwards took his nosy self over to whatever hulking computer the department had available and ran the name Richard Finley. About 1,000 hours later, I assume, because it was a computer in 1984, he discovered the truth that the real Richard Finley had passed away as an infant in 1948. This was a sure sign to the department that the man they knew as Finley had stolen an identity, which begged the question, why? So they assumed they had a criminal on their hands, but evidently arresting him for a fake identity wasn't enough. They wanted to know what crime he was trying to hide.
I bet it was bank robbery.
Astute. They should hire you at the Friendswood Police Department.
Yeah, if you tell me the whole story with the solution, I can tell you what happened.
Because he had a pilot license and took frequent trips to Mexico, they suspected that he might be a drug smuggler. They speculated also that he could be an international terrorist or just an heir avoiding inheritance tax. The Friendswood police began staking out the house. Edwards recounted that they would work off hours, and he even brought his 6-year-old son on a stakeout one night. To get more info, the police hatched a plan to root through the Finley's trash without them knowing. Police officers dressed as trash collectors and waited for the garbage truck around the corner of the Finley home. As the truck approached, they jumped aboard and dumped the Finley's trash cans into boxes they had pre-placed in the truck. I got the impression they did this multiple times because at some point a neighbor noticed that someone was going through their garbage and tipped Roxy off. She caught Captain Jimmy Holland elbow deep in her trash, and he was forced to admit that he was a police officer. Roxy asked him if she was under investigation, and he said truthfully, "No, ma'am." He made up some story about why they were going through the trash, but neither the Des Moines Register article that had a lot of details or the Masterminds episode go into detail, which is disappointing because I would love to hear the excuse they came up with for literally picking through this woman's garbage. By going through the garbage, they learned that Hadley had a passport in the name of Finley and close to $1 million in cash assets. Meanwhile, Roxy and Hadley were active members of the community. Roxy was elected to the subdivision's park board and was said to be instrumental in getting a gazebo in a neighborhood park. The couple would complain to police about anything that bothered them, and if they didn't get the response they wanted, Roxy would go straight to the city council. For 3.5 years, Lieutenant Edwards kept Hadley under surveillance, just to try to find out what crime he had committed. 3.5 years of investigating, just trying to find out what the crime was. Then, one day, in 1988, Lieutenant Edwards was opening a piece of mail the Friendswood Police Department had received from the FBI. It was unusual for the FBI to send beyond the lookouts nationwide. It was expensive and a hassle. But this was a unique occasion as the FBI was teaming up with a popular TV show to find a suspected bank robber.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Let me guess. Was it Disappeared?
In preparation for the 1988 broadcast of Unsolved Mysteries Special Number 6, the FBI sent out wanted posters of Stephen Riley Hadley across the country. Edwards was stunned when he opened the envelope and saw Richard Finley staring up at him from the paper.
He investigated this for 3 years.
Unsolved Mysteries just did one episode. I told you that Hadley and Roxy would submit complaints to the police about whatever bothered them.
Pot calling the kettle black.
Well, it was in reference to one such complaint about noisy juveniles that the police invited the, quote, Finleys down to the precinct. When they got there, Lieutenant Edwards said, "Take a seat, Mr. Hadley."
Snap!
The first thing Hadley said was, "She knows nothing about this," referring to Roxy. Then he was shown the FBI flyer and admitted it was him. Edwards said, quote, "There was a big sigh of relief," and then he said, "I'll cooperate fully, however I can." He said he was relieved for it to be over. Hadley told Edwards he'd left his old life due to a, quote, "rocky marriage," which is not an acceptable excuse.
No.
He left his old life because he was unhappy and decided to steal a bunch of money, and I feel like he was trying to put blame onto his wife, which is wrong and shitty.
Yes.
Hadley's Texas friends were shocked, but came to his defense. They saw him as a man who thumbed his nose at the system, saw a chance, and couldn't resist temptation. Roxy, for her part, refused to talk to reporters, and good for her. To the police, she maintained that she was unaware of her husband's true identity. One thing I thought was interesting was that Roxy was actually also from Iowa. So Hadley had traveled with her back to Iowa to meet her parents before they got married. And her parents lived in Iowa during the heist, and they watched the news and they got the newspapers, but apparently his bleached hair and tan skin was disguised enough that they didn't recognize him as the state's most infamous bank robber. Hadley was arrested on April 25th, 1988. He was charged with one count interstate transportation of stolen money and two counts taking and embezzling. He faced a potential 20 years in prison and a fine of $30,000. He also received a charge of using a false name to get a Social Security card, passport, and pilot license, which could have added an additional 15 years and a $250,000 fine.
What?
Right? The bank robbery has a $30,000. The Social Security card has a $250,000 fine.
Identity theft is really not cool. Like, true. That really screws over the people that it happens to.
I had to wait like a week and a half for my new ATM card when somebody stole my information, so...
That's the worst thing that's ever happened to somebody who had their information stolen.
Well, it's very inconvenient. It's not cool. It's my money and I worked for it.
No, it's not
this
cool.
This is not bank robbery. Bank robbery is a victimless crime. I'm a victim. I did double check. Credit union money is federally insured, so the credit union did not lose any money. After his arrest, Hadley's parents and their Quaker church helped to raise $50,000 bail for him, but the magistrate denied it, and he was sent back to Iowa to face trial.
Who raised bail for him?
His parents and their church. His parents.
His parents, who knew that he had stolen money and ditched his family, mm-hmm. were like, okay, cool, son. Mm-hmm. Had he been in contact with them?
I don't know. I assume not, because he was pretty dead set on not getting caught. But I never saw that mentioned in anything, so I'm not sure.
I mean, I guess I can't really see myself abandoning my family if they got arrested, but I hope they were at least giving him some side eye.
They could have just been happy to know where he was. Friends and family tried to testify to his character to get him bond. So this is where we go back to that whole well-respected man about town. He was just a normal guy. His coworkers who were interviewed for Masterminds really liked him.
At the credit union?
Yeah. His neighbors in Friendswood were all very fond.
And also suspicious of everybody and everything.
Well, that's the police. But he was just a nice, normal guy. But he was, again, denied bond in Iowa, having been deemed a risk to flee the state. So finally, on August 11th, 1988, Chandra and Athena Brown were born. And
the world became a brighter place.
And after 4 years on the run, Stephen Riley Hadley pleaded guilty to 3 felonies and was sentenced to 13 years in prison. Hadley requested to be moved to a prison in Texas to be closer to Roxy, and the judge agreed. But shortly after his sentencing, Roxy had their marriage annulled. had to be quite the betrayal to find out the person you married didn't even tell you their right name.
Not only that he didn't tell her who he was and his history, but also he already abandoned a family.
Mm-hmm. Catherine had also divorced Hadley a few months after his disappearance and retained custody of their children, who were now 5, 11, and 15. When the Des Moines Register tried to reach out to Catherine for comment, her mother, Marge Youngblood, said they're no longer involved in Hadley's life. And when you think about it, the 5-year-old was less than 1 year old when Hadley disappeared and probably didn't even remember their father. Mind you, that was in 1992, and it's possible that his children sought a relationship or something somewhere down the line. In addition to prison, Hadley was forced to pay back the money he stole, plus taxes, which I believe based on the 1988 tax rate would have been about $152,000. But Hadley had invested the money so well that he was only short $100,000. This was $1.1 million that he had to pay back, and he had almost all of it.
Oh, he was good in investing.
That's what happens when you're a banker who steals a bunch of money, I guess. Moral of the story, if you're a banker, steal some money.
No.
Invest it well.
I don't think that's the moral of the story.
Well, you're just raining in all the parades, aren't you, Shawnee?
I feel like, for legal reasons, we should state that we are opposed to robbing banks. Stealing is bad, okay?
I don't know if I can commit to that.
For legal reasons, we are opposed to robbing banks.
Hadley was released from prison on parole in 1992 after serving 4 of 13 years. In February of that year, he moved to New Directions Halfway House in Houston, where he was one of 50 residents. He has since married for a third time and lives right here in Texas. And you're damn right, I looked him up. I did find him on one of those "we publish all your personal information because there's no privacy anymore" websites, but I didn't delve that deep into it. But I did find it was funny that they had an AKA section that did not list Richard Glenn Finley, which was funny because it's the ultimate AKA. A retired Waterloo police detective named Steve Nemers was interviewed for the Masterminds episode, and he said of Stephen Hadley's heist, quote, "Nothing crime is cool, but it was gutsy," end quote. And that's the story of bank robber Stephen Riley Hadley.
Not a gentleman bank robber.
No.
If we're being honest, though.
He was a bit nicer than Connor and Dougherty. He didn't take people hostage, like, at all.
Yeah.
He didn't take a single person hostage. So, in that respect, more of a gentleman. I will say, I hope his kids had great lives, and that being abandoned by their father somehow didn't impact them too badly, because that never impacts people that badly, right?
Nah, losing parents is fine. It's totally fine.
It's not a problem. We're okay.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can link up with us on Instagram. We're at You Solved a Mystery. Or you can email us at YouSolvedMystery@gmail.com.
If you could be so kind as to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, that would be
super duper.
More than awesome. And something new that I'm going to ask for is maybe share us with a friend. If you like what you hear and you think a friend would like it too, maybe
and if you like your friends,
hey, listen to this. What? What are you talking about?
I don't know. Some people have frenemies.
Share us with your frenemies. That's fine. I don't care. Friends, frenemies.
say thank you to Raven. Thank you, Raven, because she made our music. I wasn't talking to you, Athena. As always, I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra.
Join us next time for another episode of You Solved a Mystery.